Please join us. Ladies, any further announcements before we close it out?
And lastly, this is Dr. Sorrell. Just want to remind everyone of our fourth annual awards luncheon. We're excited about this. The keynote speakers will be the Vice President of Diversity and Inclusion from Multnomah University.
Multnomah
University. You know I'm from here. And she's a young lady. We're proud of Dr. Jessica Taylor. She will be there to speak to the youth, and also our mayor of Vancouver. And Oldie, she will also be our keynote speaker. We'll be giving out several scholarships to kids that are not only in high school, that are getting ready to go to college, and we do have kids now already in college, and we support them too. So, April the 6th, 11:30 a.m. at Park Rose Middle School.
Thanks again for tuning in to our monthly segment of Labor Radio, and we will be back with you the first Monday of May 2019 on KBOO.FM. Holla!
KBOO Community Radio starts our spring membership drive starting April 8th, and before that, we'd love to hear from you directly about why you support KBOO. My name is Mo, a KBOO volunteer, and I support KBOO because I grew up with KBOO. It's part of my life, and I feel having a community outlet like KBOO is so important because it creates a more vibrant community and a place where different ideas are not only heard but honored. Why do you support KBOO? Call us and let us know at 503-231-8032, extension 302, to leave a voicemail or tag us with your support on your social media posts. And thank you for supporting KBOO.
Billy Rose was a lowrider. Billy Rose was a night fighter. Billy Rose knew trouble like the sound of his own name. Busted on a drunken charge, driving someone else's car. The local midnight sheriff's claim to fame. In an Arizona jail, there is some who tell the tale. I believe he fought the sergeant for some milk that he demanded. Knowing they'd remain the boss, knowing he would pay the cost, they saw he was severely reprimanded. In the black cell on a block, he hanged himself at dawn with a note stuck to the bunkhead. Don't mess with me, just take me home. Come and lay, help us lay young Billy down.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Hello, this is Prison Pipeline from the studios of KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Today I'll be airing audio from a performance called Shaping a Future: Life After Prison. Shaping a Future took place on October 29, 2017, at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. This performance was free, open to the public, and the culmination of a series of writing workshops organized by Carol Imani and funded by the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Shaping a Future included monologues written and read by 9 individuals who had spent time in prison. They told stories of redemption and determination related to their reentry to society after prison. They also highlighted the failings of our criminal justice system and the varied causes of criminality. This performance is being broadcast in segments. This is part 6, and it includes the 8th monologue by Judy, the Reader's Digest condensed version of my adventures. This show will also air a prison radio segment by Dante Mitchell, who, like Judy, concludes that the money being spent on our bloated criminal justice system, with about a 70% recidivism rate, could be put to better use. We'll start this show with director Chris Karsmar.
Michelle Alexander, who is more blameworthy? The young black kid who hustles on the street corner selling weed to help his mom pay rent? Or the college kid who deals drugs out of his dorm room so that he'll have enough cash to finance his spring break? Who should we fear? The kid in the hood who joined a gang and now carries a gun for security because his neighborhood is frightening and unsafe? Or the suburban high school student who has a drinking problem but keeps getting behind the wheel of a car? Piper Kerman. 200 women, no phones, no washing machines, no hair dryers. It was like Lord of the Flies on estrogen. We will now hear from Judy with the Reader's Digest condensed version of my adventures.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to share my condensed version into my many incarcerations and my final reentry into being a contributing member of society. I always felt like I had the ideal childhood and no reason for falling to the wayside. I had a picture-perfect upbringing with loving, doting parents who took every opportunity to shower me with affection and guidance. I grew up on a 100-acre farm southeast of Portland in Colton, Oregon. I was a church-going, straight-A student until I hit puberty, and the 60s swept me up in a current of protests, free love, and of course, the drug scene. I was on top of the world. My parents never told me any of this fun stuff. I was having a ball, but my family was having a cow. I couldn't understand why, when I was 14, they refused to allow me to go to LA with my 16-year-old boyfriend for a couple of months while he was working with friends of ours who were a few years older. So against their wishes, instead of going to school, I went to check out California. At that time, I was barely attending school anyway. I was too busy stealing cars and partying. Without even packing a change of clothes, my boyfriend, another friend, and I stuck out our thumbs, and away we went on our exciting journey. After a couple of months of a lot of fun and more than a few scary situations where my life was in danger, I was more than ready to go home. But before I could hitchhike back, I was picked up by the police as a runaway. And this was my formal introduction to the Department of Justice. My parents flew me home, and I didn't even say thanks. Does this mean that I learned my lesson? Of course not. I was just getting started. My thoughts were I was grown. At the age of 16, I got married and had a couple of kids. My husband was extremely abusive, both physically and emotionally. For the first time in my life, I realized that I was not that grown at all. Square as they were, Mom and Dad did know a little bit about life after all. During this period, about 3 years, I didn't use drugs or commit many crimes, just a little shoplifting here and there. My husband never had a job the entire time we were married. Our fantasy was that love would pay the bills. That was awfully mature thinking, wouldn't you think? We thought so at the time. We split up several times, but the final time came when I had met someone new and was able to end that first relationship for good. Little did I know that I was going straight from the frying pan into the fire. In no time at all, I was pregnant again. It seemed like I was always pregnant. I married my second husband when I was 7 months along, only because he seemed frantic about not wanting to have an illegitimate child. After my third daughter was born, the physical abuse became so severe that my cousins intervened. They wrestled my husband into a car one day, took him to the airport, and sent him to his sister's, who lived in Hawaii. I never saw him again. My youngest daughter was barely a year old. Here I was, alone again, but now with three young children, and not a clue what I was going to do. After that, I made a decision that I would never again be a punching bag for any man. The days of walking on eggshells and cowering in corners were gone. I was raised in a family who believed men didn't put their hands on women. It was such a foreign concept that it was never even a topic of discussion. In fact, society itself had not yet conceived the phrase domestic violence. Somewhere along the path of two failed marriages, my common sense had flown straight out the window, if I ever had any to begin with. I was 21, and I felt I had finally figured out the solution to a successful relationship. Instead of running like the devil was breathing down my neck at the first inkling of violence, I came up with this brilliant solution. If a man ever again raised his hands to strike me, I would fight back with everything I had within me. As you could probably imagine, hell's gates opened wide and swallowed me whole. As a high school dropout, I couldn't find a job that paid the bills. Rent, food, and paying for a babysitter for three young kids wasn't cheap, even in the 70s. That was also my excuse for the choices I made. While drugs and alcohol were an escape in the beginning, they soon became a necessity. Since a paycheck wasn't going to cover the bills and a heroin habit, I soon resorted to the better paying criminal enterprises. I was young, sweet, privileged white woman who could get away with everything and then some, just by batting my sweet baby blues. The world was my oyster. Little did I realize that my oyster would soon turn out to be the penitentiary. Up until that time, I was just getting short county stints. And then on my sixth and seventh felony convictions, where the judge even apologized, stating he had no alternative but to sentence me to prison. And since once wasn't enough, I needed to see if things worked out differently in other states. It turns out they do. They get worse. Every time I went back to prison, I ended up with more time. Also, through my continued visits in and out of jails and prisons, I lost custody of my two oldest kids to their father, my first husband. I was devastated. And honestly, I couldn't figure out what my problem was. Sadly, I kept looking for a solution at the bottom of a bottle and through a needle in my arm. The only time I was clean and sober is when I was locked up. Treatment was just becoming available at this time, which wasn't much beyond AA. They had a single methadone clinic here in Portland at the Henry Building downtown, or at Dixon's Pharmacy in Southeast Portland. Those didn't include counseling in the early years either. The reasons behind criminal behavior weren't yet a topic. Throughout this madness, I somehow managed to keep custody of my youngest daughter, Jackie, who's sitting right over there. That was probably because her stepdad retained steady employment, staying out of the justice system despite his drinking and drugging. Plus, we hadn't heard a word from her biological father since he left. I had always thought we did fairly well when it came to parenting, but I guess that's a lie addicts often tell themselves to avoid having to face their guilt and the reality of the show that their life really is. Since I was a thief and a forger, we had to look the part of the normal family. It always seemed as though Jackie was rather well-adjusted. She was very outgoing, made friends easily, and was popular in the neighborhood and at school. It never occurred to me that my lifestyle had affected any of my children so adversely until they were well into their adulthood. Recently, I've considered, through my daughter's urgings, to explore how this became my life story. It seems unbelievable I was so blind when I now recall all the violence and drama that accompanies such a dysfunctional lifestyle of criminality and addiction. Come to think about it, I shouldn't have been so surprised when my two younger daughters would also spend time in prison themselves. In a sick and twisted way, I even cherished the idea that we now had something that would enable us to bond and relate to one another through shared trauma. This is the first time that I've ever admitted this to anybody, and I'm still trying to understand what it is that I'm attempting to describe. It certainly isn't pride, and I'm definitely not boasting about the three of us and our prison experiences. Time is relative. In a day-to-day life in society, time passes in the blink of an eye. Days float by without much thought. In prison, time screeches to a halt. You honestly feel each and every tick, tick, ticking by excruciatingly slow. It felt like the following day would never arrive and that a release date was in the next lifetime. My daughters and I now share this exact same horror, for that is what it was. We could look at one another in the eyes and know that we have all three faced this devastation, holding one another with compassion and understanding of life and hell, and how precious freedom can be. It changes a person, sometimes for the better, more often for the worst. I am grateful to have found a bridge that I hadn't yet burned. I haven't used heroin in over 20 years, and my last drink was October 1st, 2006. I'm truly blessed to have the opportunity to repair and rebuild some of the wreckage I've inflicted on my family and my community and myself for way too many years. To salvage these relationships I so cherish, and I'm happy to say it's still a work in progress. I would like to leave you with these final thoughts. The public is persuaded to believe that tougher, longer sentences will reduce crime. This is a common theme for many candidates running for office. What they don't mention is that the rate of recidivism is continually increasing despite the tough on crime approach. According to a recent CNN interview with Democratic Senator Dick Durbin and Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, recidivism rates have soared for people who are released from correctional institutions. 68% reoffend within 3 years, and 77% of them return to prison within 5 years. Well, that's clearly not solving the problem, is it? These senators are heading a bipartisan effort for justice reformation. If our country is willing to spend enormous amounts of taxpayers' money on mass incarceration, shouldn't those dollars be put to better use? Like, take that money and include a comprehensive evaluation for each person entering the prison system to determine the underlying reasons why they came in contact with the justice system in the first place. We need to increase that individual's chances for a successful reentry back into society by offering drug and alcohol treatment, mental health and treatment for trauma, vocational and educational programs, and basic life skill training, as so many individuals have been born into dysfunction. These things are necessary to combat the revolving doors of our jails and prisons. We learned the skills that sent us to prison, and now we need to be taught new skills to maintain our freedom. That should not be so hard for our society to understand. Thank you.
Helen Eisner, Ellisoner, excuse me. With 2 million people behind bars, it is worth asking what America gets for its money. It is hard to argue that the imprisonment of hundreds of thousands of people for nonviolent drugs possessions offenses was cost effective. In the early 1970s, when the war on drugs began, it cost around $110 million a year. President George W. Bush's fiscal year 2003 budget proposed $19.2 billion to fight drugs. And the drugs trade continues unabated. From Rumi, become the sky, take an axe to the prison wall, escape. A Mexican proverb, they tried to bury us. They didn't know that we were seeds.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline from KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. You just heard the Reader's Digest condensed version of My Adventures by Judy from Shaping a Future Life After Prison. Next is a prison radio segment by Dante Mitchell, who has spent 22 years in prison in New York State for an armed robbery he committed at 17. During his time, he has reformed himself against all odds and has begun to help younger incarcerated individuals, especially preventing them from becoming entrenched in the violence of prison. This is Pay for Medication and Education, Not Prison by Dante Mitchell, submitted March 11th, 2019.
I had planned to speak more about my federal lawsuit in TLS, but I was watching this local news program called Empire State Weekly, and they were speaking about a looming budget fight in the state government. We already know there's a $2.3 billion shortfall in income tax revenue in New York State. Now there are proposals to make cuts in medical care and education. I mean, really? So much money can be saved reforming our criminal justice and prison systems. But there's very little talk about that. Why cut funding to essential services people need when we can do more to lower crime and prison recidivism rates and close down more prisons, which are not essential to ensuring public safety? It's bad enough people can't afford their prescription medication and that EMS services are closing due to a lack of funding, but we have this massive prison industrial complex that is draining tax dollars to perpetuate a failing system. One big factor contributing to crime is socioeconomic inequality. There are gross disparities in wealth and education in this country that lead to crime in economically depressed neighborhoods, especially in communities of color. Unlike the left-leaning progressives, I don't believe in forced redistribution of wealth. However, I believe in increasing opportunities for poor, black, and Hispanic Americans. This is why I created UFD, the Ujamaa Fraternal Dynasty. By teaching classic self-help principles of success and entrepreneurship and creating a fraternal association through which these principles can be put into effect, I will be able to spur economic development in disadvantaged communities and thereby lowering crime rates further and increasing income tax revenue. This I can do. I am uniquely qualified to do it. I have been teaching and training myself to do exactly this for many years. But instead of releasing me from prison so I can begin the work in earnest, the state is shelling out about $60,000 a year to keep me in prison for no good reason. Just a waste of money that could be used to help an elderly person pay for needed medication or help a few young students get a college education. Let's take a closer look at the question of prison reform. Governor Cuomo proposed to close only 3 state prisons, but no mention was made about decreasing the prison population further through innovative prison reform like those being implemented in North Dakota based on the model used in Norway. Norway's prison system has a 20% recidivism rate compared to the United States' 76.6% rate. For every 100,000 persons, Norway only incarcerates 63 people compared to the 655 people per 100,000 persons the United States incarcerates. The goal of the Norwegian prison system is to create good neighbors. So instead of punishing and disciplining prisoners and subjecting them to harsh treatment, the Norwegian prison system treats its prisoners as human beings, even calling them residents and not prisoners or inmates or offenders. Something about their system works with only a 20% recidivism rate. Critics in this country who feel prisoners shouldn't be treated nice will call Norway's prison system soft. But ask yourself this. Would you rather be able to pay for your prescription medication and put your kid through college without going into debt? Or would you rather see prisoners treated badly who only come out worse as a result? Because that's how your taxpayer dollars are being spent while you're barely making ends meet. This is Dante S. Mitchell, better known as the File Mason Keeble, reporting to you from Great Meadow Correctional Facility in Comstock, New York. Follow me on Facebook at Free Dante Mitchell. Thank you for listening, and God bless.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline from KBOO Portland. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. Thank you to Judy for allowing me to feature your monologue tonight. Thank you to all the participants of Shaping a Future, Life After Prison. This was part 6. Thank you, Dante Mitchell and Prison Radio. Pair Dante Mitchell's words with Until We Reckon, Violence, Mass Incarceration, and A Road to Repair by Danielle Sarid, featured on Democracy Now! On March 14, 2019. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. I'll end with a preview of Shaping a Future, Life After Prison, Part 7, featuring Jackie. Jackie is Judy's youngest daughter. Jackie's monologue is titled, Long Time Coming.
Hi, everyone. I'd like to tell you a story about a little girl bouncing around from place to place, never landing anywhere for too long, encountering different degrees of stress and trauma, all at a toxic level, and how those experiences shaped my existence. My story is about heartbreak, loss, and grief, but also about triumph, healing, and redemption. It's about how God can make miracle out of messes, and how He can transform your pain into your passion. I was born into this life to two people swimming in the midst of their dysfunction. My mom, having escaped a torrential and extremely violent relationship, and my father, trudging through a murky abyss of grief, having been dealt the blow of losing both parents to a senseless tragedy not many years before. Everything my father hated in life, he became. And with the odds stacked against their relationship, it's not hard to see how my parents didn't make it through the storm. They split before I got a good chance to know the man that brought me into this world. And sadly, God would call him to rest before that glorious day I would get a chance. To stand before him as his only child. And say, Dad, I love you and thank you for what you've done to bring me into this world. More importantly, I would say to him, I forgive you. Because of my own lived experience, I can truly identify how trauma can impact who we are and what we become. Thankfully, I still have my dear old mom here, graciously accepting my never-ending invitation to participate in events along the lines of these. Despite me having to beg, bribe, and barter, and sometimes drag her kicking and screaming, I still get her here. And after all that's said and done, through the stress and anxiety of dates and deadlines, we still managed to have a few laughs. And actually, endless humor, accented by sometimes bizarre, but entertaining and unconventional spurts of growth, development, and healing. Not many moms would have the courage to be confronted with all that has taken place, especially if it's ugly.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Urban League of Portland Career Connections Job Fair on Tuesday, April 2nd at 10 a.m. at the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland. The Urban League of Portland Career Connections Job Fair features government, nonprofit, and private sector employers from around the Pacific Northwest who are looking for employees. Again, that's the Urban League Career Connections Job Fair on Tuesday, April 2nd from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Lloyd Center Mall in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences